Started. Here we go. Okay.
Well, welcome to what is the beginning, the introduction to our study in the book of Daniel. And I have been looking forward to this. I know many of you have been looking forward to this. Tonight, we're going to do a couple of things. I'm going to just give you some introductory notes, talk a little bit about some of the background to it, and we're going to read chapter 1 together tonight, and then also begin to discuss it. Now, what I will do is, God willing, next week, I will have copies of these notes for you. But the fact is, I got through 3.5 out of what will eventually be 6 or 7 pages worth of notes. And I don't want to give incomplete notes out. So we're going to go through some of that tonight. I was not so naive as to think that we were going to get through my entire intro tonight, because it's just not my style to get through anything very quickly. But let's talk about this. And for those of you, if you're taking notes, and I really encourage you to do that, even when I give you these handouts, I encourage you as much as possible to take notes. And let me just go on a bit of a tangent for a moment and tell you why. Educators have determined that you retain about 45% of things that you just hear, about 65% of things that you see. When it's combined seeing and hearing together, it goes even up into the 70 percentile. But when you hear and see and do, it shoots up into the 90 percentile. So I encourage you to take notes. For those of you who are, I've actually given a thematic title to our series in Daniel, and it's called Proven, Purified, and Perfected. Proven, Purified, and Perfected. And I've got a couple of verses that I'm using as thematic verses for Daniel. One of them is Daniel 2:47. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." And the reason that I chose that as one of the thematic verses is because it's my contention that God had such grand and incredible purposes for having the Jewish people go into Babylon. You want to talk about killing several birds with one stone? We needed the discipline because we had been disloyal to God. And he had warned us, if you won't walk in my ways here in your own land, I'll send you into somebody else's land. So we needed the discipline. But Babylon needed the truth. And Daniel and his friends represent God's ambassadorship to a country that didn't have the light yet. So that's why that's one of the verses. Those were the words, by the way, of Nebuchadnezzar. That's King Nebuchadnezzar saying, "Surely your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings." Wow. That could be right out of the New Testament, couldn't it? The other verse, I really should have had three. I've got two. But the other one is chapter 12, verse 10. "Many will be purged, purified, and refined, but the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but those who have insight will understand." And I have that there because Daniel is a book filled with mysteries being revealed and things requiring insight. And the fact that it does speak to the end of days when the wicked will grow more wicked. And it speaks to that whole dichotomy of light and darkness, truth and error, God's ways and the ways of Satan. So I just chose those two as a couple of the thematic verses. If I was going to choose a third, it would have been in the account of Daniel before Darius, being faithful to continue praying three times a day facing Jerusalem, even when for 30 days nobody was supposed to pray to anybody but King Darius. And when they finally bring him out of the lion's den, Darius also gives praise to God, and he praises. And all, or I would have chosen Nebuchadnezzar's when he threw Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah into the furnace. And then they come out, and he exalts the Lord God, and he says, you know, that these men were willing to even die rather than forsake their God. So, I mean, there's so much. Okay, I could have had seven thematic verses. But anyway, Daniel 2:47 and 12:10 are the ones that I chose to use for that. All right, introduction. Now, one way to get a lot of people excited about coming to a Bible study is to announce that you're going to teach about the end of time, the last days, and end time prophecy. I can pretty much guarantee you that's a way to get people to come out. The desire to know the future is something that's kind of universal to all of us. It's this universal phenomenon. Everybody wants to know. Now, perhaps knowing future events gives people a sense of perhaps being a little more in control of things, which is kind of a joke when you think about it, but nevertheless, if you know what's coming down the pike, you feel a little less out of sorts. And so people have always wanted to know the future. In any case, for whatever reason, I mean, some people play the market based on where they anticipate technologies are going to take us. And so they'll throw their investments behind companies or products that they think are going to be on the cutting edge of the next wave of whatever it is. And so they're betting their dollars on it. Whatever the reason, human beings are fascinated with the future. It's the stuff of countless science fiction movies and TV shows and books. It's also big business. As I said, speculating on technological advancements has made some people very wealthy. The yearning to know future world events is. It also drove the ancients. People have always had this drive to want to know the future. In the Torah, God didn't forbid us from knowing what the future holds, but he put parameters around it. He said, you're not to go to mediums or spiritualists. Don't get involved in sorcery or any kind of enchanting or divination or any of that. None of this psychic stuff. But he did not forbid that we should know some future things. He simply said, I will reveal those things to you through my servants, the prophets. So God said, yes, I'll let you know future things, but in my authorized way. And you don't get to know everything. You get to know enough. In fact, if you think about it in Deuteronomy, what was the most significant way of determining if this prophet was for real? Yeah. If the thing they prophesy actually happens, then you know you have a legitimate prophet on your hands. Of course, even if the thing happens, but the person says, hey, let's go over here and worship Baal, you don't follow them. But the true measure of a prophet was that the thing they announced happened. Consider these tandem messages from Isaiah and Zechariah. This first one, for those taking notes, is Isaiah 42, verses 8 and 9. Listen to this. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things have come to pass. Now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them to you. And then Zechariah chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But did not my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants the prophets, overtake your fathers? Then they repented and said, as the Lord lives, the Lord of hosts, as the Lord of hosts purposed to do to us in accordance with our ways and our deeds, so he has dealt with us. So there was a God-authorized way of knowing the future, and that was through the words of the prophets, through Jeremiah, Isaiah, Zechariah, etc. Now, the prophet Daniel predicted dramatic future events. And the thing is, he predicted them with such amazing accuracy that that modern skeptics have argued that the book had to have been written after the fact. And we'll talk more about that. Daniel, writing in the 6th century BC, foretold, for example, the rise of Alexander the Great, his swift conquest. Daniel foretold his death and the breaking up of his kingdom into 4 smaller kingdoms. Daniel foretold the desecration of the Second Temple. He prophesied the appearing of the Messiah and then the Messiah's atoning death. Daniel prophesied the destruction of the Second Temple and the end of the age. And maybe that's why Daniel is such a popular study, because the prophecies of Daniel span all the ages, all the way to the Second Coming. But why are we studying Daniel? Anyone? No, I'm just kidding. Why are we studying Daniel? Well, there's, on the one hand, we just spent a year or more going through Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. And I mean, I enjoyed it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. But this is the natural chronological way to go, because Chronicles ends, 2 Kings ends with the southern kingdom of Judah going captive into Babylon. And where is Daniel writing from? From Babylon, which also explains why a good portion of Daniel is written in Aramaic rather than Hebrew. Has to do with where he is and how far and wide he expected the distribution list to go. So it makes sense in sequence to read about Daniel, and we learn a little bit about how some of our people fared during those years in Babylon and what would become Media and Persia. But there's another reason I've opted for us to study Daniel at this time. Carl, I need a favor. If you would please go to the office, and on the lower shelves you'll see some clipboards. If you'd grab one of those clipboards and then just take a piece of blank paper from the printer. I see a lot of guests and I want to get to know you, so just, and I've got some pens, so. All right. Besides, Carl doesn't need to know why we're studying this. I leave him in the dark all the time. So it makes sense chronologically to study Daniel, because we just witnessed the exile of Judah into Babylon. But there's another reason. Scriptures warn us against being puffed up with knowledge. And can I just be honest with you? There's a lot of people walking around, and they're these big-time prophecy teachers. And there's a lot of people walking around, and they're big-time into prophecy. And they've got all this knowledge. And for what? You see, the thing about Daniel is this. The study of prophecy, if it's not accompanied by an emphasis on godly character, all it's going to do is fill us with pride. And Daniel's filled with prophecy, but it's also what's so wonderful about the book of Daniel. It combines prophecy with stories of what godly courage looks like. You know, as they say, in real time. This is what faith looks like in real time. And I really wanted to do something where we're not just filling our heads with knowledge, but being challenged by examples of courageous, faithful men. And so that's kind of why I wanted also to do that. Thank you, my friend. And I'm going to send this around. If everybody would just print your name. And I mean, those of you I know, you don't need to do this. But if you're here for the first time, if you wouldn't mind also put your email address so we can stay in touch with you. If we're ever going to cancel for some reason or we've got something special going on, we want to be able to stay in touch. I do read Hebrew. I do read Greek. I can even read Ugaritic with a little help, but I don't do hieroglyphics. So please print your name neatly. And you can print Donna's since she decided to be rebellious. And Erica's since she's going to go do what Donna does. All right. So I really like the fact that the book of Daniel is not just a bunch of prophecy, but it's also godliness and courage. And honestly, I think we're going to need that. It's my contention that we are at the end of times. I really believe we're in the last of the last days. You know, we get all bent out of shape, and I confess I get bent out of shape when I see the rights of Christians, whether here or in other countries, being trampled on. But let's face it, it is not going to get better. Unless I have completely misread Matthew chapter 24, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. I think every opportunity we have to witness these men and women of God who stood up courageously and did the right thing, even when it meant endangering their lives, we need as much of that as we can get. Because they were just flesh and blood, just like we were, like we are. What made them special? God gave them the courage they needed at the time they needed it. I don't know that Daniel walked around going, I'll be fine, let them come for my head. These are human beings. We all have a survival instinct. But our faithfulness to the God of Israel has to transcend the momentary fear that we have. And I believe he'll give us the grace that we need in the hour we need it. But doesn't it help when we know that we've got these examples of men and women who've gone before us? We're not trailblazing, guys. That's a well-trodden path, and we're going to be in good company. So that's another reason why I thought that the book of Daniel was so good for us to read. All right, now I have here a sequence of events, or really kind of more like a timeline of Israel's history leading up to Daniel. So for those of you taking notes, let me do this if I can in sort of a picture, a timeline going across the sanctuary. All right? It's about 2000 BC, the time of Abraham, to about 1800 BC, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Our people go willingly initially into Egypt about 1875 BC. Our people, Joseph is reunited with Jacob and says, come to Egypt because the famine still has several more years ahead. I will provide for you. So Jacob, whose other name is Israel, comes to Egypt. So the man named Israel, standing for Israel, comes to Egypt. And now Israel's going to be in Egypt for 400 years. And it wasn't easy. And then we came out. I hold the Exodus to have taken place about 1446 BC. Some people think it's in the 1270s or 1280s. I hold to an earlier date, 1446. Israel comes out of Egypt 4 centuries later. 2 million people from what had been 75. 2 million people. And we come out of Egypt. We're one generation in the wilderness because we just didn't believe that God was really going to bring us in. And we believed the 10 spies instead of the 2. And so we were consigned to wander for 40 years. About 1406, Joshua is going to now bring us into the land, and the conquest of Canaan begins. We have from about 1400 BC to about 1100 BC, the period of the judges. What was that like? roller coaster, right? Israel would be okay for a while, but then we'd fall into idolatry. God would allow either the Midianites or some other people group to start invading and attacking. And we would cry out to the Lord, and he would send us a judge, whether Jephthah or Samson or Deborah. He would send us a judge, and then we'd be all right for a while, and then we'd fall back into idolatry. And so the period of the judges is very much up and down. And the period of judges transitions into the period of the kings, and who's our central character there in that transition? Like Joshua was the transition from the Sinai to Canaan, who is the man that you would say was our transition from the period of the judges into the period of the kings? Samuel. Samuel. So Samuel anoints Saul and later David. David rules. Solomon, his son, rules. And then, of course, due to the unfaithfulness, I don't know if you remembered this. I was reminded of it just the other day, that Solomon built pagan shrines on the Mount of Olives. And God, for David's sake, did not rip the kingdom out of Solomon's hand. He let him go to his fathers in peace. But after Solomon's death, the kingdom is divided now, right? North and south. Israel in the north with Samaria as its capital, Judah in the south with Jerusalem as its capital. And then you have several centuries of kings. Good time? Not very. A few good kings along the way in Judah. Uzziah was good, Hezekiah was good, Josiah was phenomenal. None of them perfect, but they were good kings. How about up in Israel? Right? It's just a series of bad kings, bad times in Israel. And why were things so bad in Israel versus Judah? It's because the foundation was flawed. Remember, what's the guy's name whose name will now live forever in infamy? Jeroboam, very good. Jeroboam, son of Nebat. And when you say his name, you're supposed to. Anyway, Jeroboam had built those pagan altars up in Dan and in Bethel with priests that were not descended from the tribe of Levi. He just set up whoever wanted to be a priest, give them a little money. Here you go. Here's your certificate. Kind of like Universal Life Church. Send us $10. We send you your ordination. Right? He puts up these shrines with golden calves, one in Dan, way up in the north, the other in Bethel, pretty close to Judea, and these golden calves. And he says, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And if you're biblically knowledgeable, you're going, "Oh my, that sounds grotesquely familiar. That's what Aaron said when he made the golden calf." So Israel in the north got off to a terrible start because it was a flawed foundation. If the foundation's bad, what happens is you build up. It gets worse. So in 722, Israel in the north went captive into Assyria. Century and a half later, 587, well, it really began in 605 in three waves. But finally, 587, Judah goes captive into Babylon. That brings us to where we are now. So now you'll have all this on the handy-dandy notes, but here's what I want to be able to encourage you to do. My goal is not to just fill your head with knowledge. My goal is not to impress you with my knowledge. My goal is to equip you, right? Isn't that what God appointed pastors and teachers to do, to equip the saints for the work of service? I would like every one of you to be able to, if somebody said, "Can you tell me Israel's history in a nutshell?" Do what I just did, right? Do what I just did. And I think many of you could do that. I want to encourage you, and that's also part of the reason why we're staying in chronology here. All right, let's talk a little bit, before we get into Daniel itself, let's talk a little bit about Babylon. Who can tell me the first mention of this place? Anybody know? Rena. It is in Genesis. Can anybody tell me the name of the guy who founded it? Rena. Nimrod. A mighty hunter before the Lord. Right? Nimrod founded Babel. Babel is translated in Sumerian, the gate of God. It was founded in Sumer, or what's called in Genesis, Shinar, to the east by Nimrod. It's Genesis 10, verses 8 through 10. And it's at it's in the beginning of what we call the Table of the Nations. This is where everybody decided, you know what? Never mind the fact that God wanted us to spread out. Let's stick together and let's build ourselves a tower and a city and make a name for ourselves. Now, Babylonian tradition held that the city was founded by Marduk. Does the name Marduk sound a little bit familiar? That's where we get Mordecai from. I just threw that out there because there are some people in the fringes of the Messianic movement that just have this fiendish delight in bad-mouthing the church for celebrating Easter because it's named after Ishtar, Babylonian deity, and we're not to have anything to do with paganism, forgetting conveniently that the book of Esther, her name Esther is from Ishtar. Her cousin Mordecai is named after Marduk. It's one thing for something once upon a time, way back when, to have had pagan origins. It's another thing when it has no association with that today. Does anybody have an ethical problem calling Thursday Thursday? Because you know it's named after Thor. Yeah. Does anybody have a problem calling Saturday Saturday? It's named after Saturn, not the planet, the false deity. I mean, there's all kinds of things that just have long since been detached from their pagan origins. And I threw this out there because too many people are hung up on words and names. And it's not a sign of wisdom. It's a sign of immaturity and potentially arrogance. So I want us to not get hung up on that. But anyway, all that because the Babylonian tradition was that Marduk founded the city of Babel. Now, their tradition is that Babel had been initially destroyed by Sargon in 2350 BC. Now, the archaeological remains at the site of Babylon date right now, the earliest that we've found, as far as I know, is somewhere between 1800 and 2000 BC. But the Babylonian tradition was that there were many things that occurred before that time in that location. And of course, that's consistent with what Genesis tells us. Anyway, we haven't gone deep enough yet, I guess, archaeologically. Let's see. Now, what do we know about Babel? What did they do there? All of mankind was united in one language, right? And don't know what that language was, but everybody was speaking the same language. And we decided to build a tower, what we would call a ziggurat. And really, it was an act of rebellion against God, who did not want mankind to all concentrate in one place. But when you think about it, this tower was an act of rebellion against God. So ever since then, Babylon, and in particular Babel, was not just a place, but it symbolized man's rebellion against God. It came to be a symbol of everything having to do with man rebelling against God. It stood as a symbol that way. As a kingdom, Babylon flourished under Hammurabi. Does that name sound familiar? He wrote a code that bears some resemblance to what are our Ten Commandments. They are variations of it are contained within the Hammurabi Code. Now, some liberal skeptics and scoffers have argued that Moses just stole it all from Hammurabi. I suggest that God, even before he gave the Torah to Israel, was giving mankind little glimmers of light and truth, and Hammurabi got it. Babylon flourished under him. He lived about 1750 BC. A century and a half later, Babylon was actually captured by the Hittites, later by the Assyrians. But all of this is before we get to where we are with Babylon. Between the late 8th and early 7th centuries, Assyria governed and had annexed Babylon. But then in 626 BC, Nabopolassar, not that different from Nebuchadnezzar, but it's not the same guy. I don't know where they get the names. But anyway, Nabopolassar overthrew the Assyrians in 626. Nebuchadnezzar that we read about in the book of Daniel is actually Nebuchadnezzar II. He's actually Nebuchadnezzar II, son of Nabopolassar. Nebuchadnezzar lived 605 to 562 BC. And Nebuchadnezzar was to his day what Herod the Great was in the first century. He loved his building projects, his architectural masterpieces. And Nebuchadnezzar really built up Babylon significantly. The Assyrians had done a lot of damage over the years. He rebuilt everything, just everything. In fact, he commissioned the construction of what's called the Ishtar Gate. And you can actually see the Ishtar Gate. It's in a museum in Berlin today. It's been preserved. What's the name of the museum? The Pergamum Museum in Berlin. Oh, that's funny. Because Pergamum was the seat of Satan in Revelation. Interesting. The Ishtar Gate in the Museum of Pergamum. Great. Okay. And we're all just going to go right to Berlin to see that. Okay. In 539 BC, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, because really when we're the Babylon we're reading about in Daniel is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, because it's the Babylonian Empire after the recapturing from Assyria and the rebuilding. So 539, Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia, killed Belshazzar, and it remained Persia until Alexander the Great took over. Thank you. Somebody decided to write in Hebrew. Okay. Donna will have to work on your Dalit.
I wrote backwards.
Oh, you wrote backward. No wonder it looks like Hebrew. Okay, thank you, Osirik. Okay, all right. All right. I do see some new faces. Let me just quickly get introduced to anybody that I don't fill. Nancy, it's good to see the Goodmans back. Noah, good to see you guys. Let's see, over here, what's your name?
I'm Jim Sanders.
Jim, welcome. And
Dale,
welcome, guys. And let's see, Ellen, hi. Hi, what's your name?
Katie.
Katie. Welcome. Let's see. Oh, yeah, hi. What's your name?
Marilyn.
Marilyn. Welcome. Let's see, did I miss anybody? Yeah, somebody's new way in the back there. Writing. Okay, that's okay. All right, well, anyway, welcome, everybody, and glad that you're here. All right. Just before we start reading, I want to share with you something. While Saddam Hussein was still alive and ruling in Iraq, he fancied himself a Nebuchadnezzar III. He had inscriptions made to that effect, having an image of Nebuchadnezzar over here and himself over here, coinage and things like that. He had a lavish royal palace built for himself at Babylon. Now, bear in mind that the actual archaeological site of Babylon is about 90 kilometers south of Baghdad. So he lived in Baghdad, but he's El Jefe, so he wants to have a palace in Babylon also. He can have a palace in Babylon. But you know what he did? He built it right on top of the ruins of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. Literally brick on brick. Archaeologists were horrified because that's not how you preserve antiquity. And in less than 10 years, the things were already falling apart. All right. Daniel's identity in the captivity. Now, this is where those of you who have been with us through Samuel and Kings and Chronicles will remember that in the first wave of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion, which is 605 BC, he took some of the nobility, some of the nobles, and some of the tradesmen captive into Babylon. He took some treasure out of the treasury, but he also took some of the nobility with him. And that's when Daniel and company would have gone into Babylon in that first wave of the invasion. So we're figuring about 605 BC is when Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as... Okay, just making sure you know. All right. That's when they would have gone into Babylon among the nobility. And this is consistent with what we're going to read when we come to chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. It says, among the nobles, they looked for youths that had intelligence and no defects and good-looking and smart and the whole thing. The Hebrew word that's used to describe these youths is yeladim. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with Hebrew, that might not seem like a big deal. Okay, that's interesting. But I think we have been weaned on this idea that Daniel and his friends were already well into their teenage years. But there's a different word for a youngish man or a youth that's typically used in Hebrew, and that's na'ar, not yeled. Yeled is a little guy. Na'ar is like Levi, my son, he's 17. Okay, he would be a na'ar. Still a youth, but the idea of getting older. But the word yeladim is used, so I'm thinking, how old really was Daniel? How old were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? There's a certain amount of flexibility with terms in Hebrew, but I just want you to be open to the idea that maybe they weren't in their mid to late teens. They might have been 9 or 10. They might have been even a little younger. I doubt it, but I just want us to not be dogmatic and insist that they had to be a certain age. We do know that Daniel was elderly by the time of Darius. So, I mean, it makes a certain amount of sense that perhaps he was in his teens, but, you know, you'd have to do a lot of number crunching, and I don't think we can say dogmatically. Yeah, Shadrika? Yeah, the children of nobility. And they were given 3 years to learn the language and the literature of the Chaldeans, right? Who learns language faster, kids or teens? Kids. 3 years is not a whole long time to be completely familiar with the language and the literature of that culture. I'm not saying that they weren't teens. I'm just saying be flexible. They might have been a little younger than that. And the Hebrew word yeladim at least gives some basis for that. That was a long time talking about a little thing. All right. Daniel is described as repeatedly as having exceptional insight, even understanding visions and dreams. On multiple occasions, he's given insight into divine mysteries. And as we go through especially the earlier chapters of Daniel, his courage and his wisdom and diplomacy saved a lot of lives. And I don't just mean Jewish lives. I mean some Chaldean lives too. But, you know, the thing is, Before you and me, the readers of Daniel, ever get to all this insight and mysteries and night visions, we're introduced to a young man who has principle and courage. And that to me is huge. Long before we get to all the supernatural stuff, he and his friends show that they are principled. And it just kind of reminded me, you know, many will say on that day, Lord, in your name did we not cast out demons and perform miracles and do this? And he'll say, I never knew you. Principle, godliness has got to come first before we get all enthralled with supernatural stuff. I'm not against supernatural stuff, don't get me wrong. But we've got to be people of principle, people of the word, people of integrity before we decide that we're going to become a super prophet or whatever. Okay, authorship and date. Here's where things get a little bit hot. J.C. Whitcomb, a scholar who wrote an entry for the Illustrated Bible Dictionary, he wrote this. Modern critical scholarship is practically unanimous in its rejection of the book as a 6th century B.C. document written by Daniel. In spite of the testimony of the book itself, and the statement of our Lord that the desolating sacrilege was, quote, spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Yeshua in Matthew 24:15 says the prophet Daniel spoke about these things. Well, he credited it to Daniel. Critics claim that the book was compiled by an unknown author about 165 B.C. Now, think about this. Daniel's in Babylon in the 6th century B.C., and people are arguing that the thing wasn't written until the 2nd century B.C.? Why would they argue that way? Because it contains prophecies of post-Babylonian kings and wars, which supposedly become increasingly accurate as they approach that date. Well, think about it. When did Alexander the Great live? In the 4th century B.C. How would somebody living in the 6th century B.C. know about somebody hundreds of years later? Well, it's called prophecy. But the thing is, the book of Daniel is so pinpoint in its accuracy that skeptics assume that, nah, I don't buy that. I think somebody came along later and wrote it, knowing all that happened and when it happened, and put it in the mouth of a person who lived earlier. For the record, I hold the claim of the book and the affirmation of Messiah Yeshua to be true and accurate, namely that this is a 6th century B.C. book bearing the name of its rightful author. It's my contention that those who question or deny its claimed date and author do so because of an anti-supernatural bias. They either deny the existence of God altogether, and if there is no God, how can there be such a thing as somebody prophesying things that haven't happened yet? That would be a supernatural thing. Or a deistic